Genesis 3:8 through 24, the sixth talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on March 26, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I left off last time in, or the time before last, in mid-chapter 3 of Genesis, but I had many more questions after last Sunday, and then during the week. And so I would like to answer some. I would like to respond to some of those questions, but I would like to first finish up chapter 3 of Genesis so we make some progress here. We left off at verse 8, so I'll start reading there. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. Then the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of thee in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself." And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" And the man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me from the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." And the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you more than all the cattle, and more than every beast of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. And he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." To the woman he said, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you shall bring forth children. Yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." Then to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. And you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Now the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all the living. And the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and clothed them. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he stretch out his hand, and take also from the tree of life, and eat and live forever." Therefore the Lord God sent him out from the garden of Eden to cultivate the ground from which he was taken. So he drove the man out, and at the east of the garden of Eden he stationed the cherubim and the flaming sword, which turned every direction to guard the way to the tree of life. The events that just preceded this were, of course, when the Adam and Eve both took from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was the one tree in the whole garden that they were forbidden to eat from. And at the urging of the serpent, and in a desire to be like God, they ate from the fruit and immediately felt the shame and guilt of having done so, and recognized that they were naked. So they made from fig leaves, they made loincloths to cover themselves. So they have made these very rudimentary clothing, and They're in the garden, and they hear God coming. This is, they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. It's possible that this is not the first time that God has done that. It's possible that from time to time God had come during this time of the day and walked. It sounds like this might not be the first time. They recognize the sound. But having heard the sound, they hide. They know they've done something wrong. They know that they're guilty before God. It's silly for them to hide, just as it was silly for them to make the clothes. It's a very incomplete, inadequate, inept response to the problem. But that's what they do. They're guilty. They don't know what to do with themselves. God calls out to them. God's the one who makes the first approach here. He calls out and asks where they are. Obviously, he knew where they were, but he calls out to them. Man says, Adam responds, "I was afraid because I was naked." God's response to that indicates that there are two ways that he could know he's naked. One way would be if someone told him he was naked. The only way he could be conscious of his nakedness. It says earlier they were naked, but they were not ashamed. Well, now he's naked and ashamed. There's only two ways that he could know, be aware of, self-conscious of his nakedness and vulnerability. One is someone told him. And the other is that he ate of the fruit. And obviously he ate of the fruit. That's how he knew. He knows he's naked because he feels his guilt and vulnerability. He's exposed. God asks him at that point, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat?" God knew the answers to both questions. God often asks questions he knows the answers to. But he wants Adam to face up to it. Adam's response is to deflect the blame. Instead of admitting to it, facing up to it, and asking forgiveness, which would have been the ideal response, his response is, "The woman gave it to me." And not just the woman gave it to me, but the woman that you gave me. So he's trying to deflect the blame onto God, ultimately. God then turns to Eve. And she does a similar thing. Let's see. "Then the Lord God said to the woman, 'What is this you have done?' And the woman said, 'The serpent deceived me, and I ate.'" So she deflects blame then onto the serpent. Now, I find this interesting because it is so much a part of human nature to do this. Children do it most ineptly and most blatantly. You ask them, what happened here? Who did this? Like, I'll use an illustration I've used before, but we had just moved into our house. My parents had just moved into a house here in Eugene and put in a new lawn. And the next morning, there was a bicycle tire track right across the lawn in a rut. And my mother was quite certain she knew who did it, so she went up and approached this boy and said, "Billy," I think Billy was his name, "Billy, did you ride across our lawn?" And his response was, "My sister's bike did it." It's a lovely response. Very Clintonian. But what our response, children do it most ineptly and most blatantly. What happens as we get older is not that we outgrow that, but we become more sophisticated at it. But deflecting blame is a full-time job as a human being. One of the things that we are most afraid of doing is looking into things squarely, facing into things as they really are. We are constantly wanting to deflect blame, make ourselves look better than we really are. And we become very good at it. In fact, we become so good that we cease to realize that we're doing it. Then God, in response, he proclaims a curse on the serpent, and then it doesn't say that he curses the man and the woman. The only thing that it says that he curses is the serpent, and then later the ground. But he proclaims if I don't call it a curse, what am I going to call it? He tells the man and the woman how things will be different now as a result of what they have done. To the serpent, what he says to the serpent, I think, is ultimately not being said to the serpent. But God's words are really being addressed to the power behind the serpent. Satan is ultimately the one to whom he is addressing his curse. And everything that he says is in the form of a metaphor. He's talking to the serpent, but the serpent then becomes a picture of the ultimate reality that will be true of Satan. So the serpent becomes, for us, this living metaphor in life. That when we look at a serpent, we can be reminded of these words that were proclaimed with respect to Satan, with a spiritual meaning, with a more significant meaning. What he says will happen is that the serpent will be cursed. Cursed are you more than all the cattle and more than every beast of the field. So Satan is going to be the most cursed of all God's creatures. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat. In the ancient Near East, in the carvings that you can see on the walls of the temples in the ancient Near East, especially this is true of the Assyrian carvings, when an Assyrian king would defeat another nation, the way that he would signify his victory is to have the king of the defeated nation lie down on his stomach in front of him, and he would put his foot on the head of the defeated king. So to crawl on your belly and to eat dust means to be defeated, to be completely defeated. And I think that's the picture that's being painted here, that Satan will be completely and utterly defeated, ultimately. And God says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. So the enmity is between the woman, and we'll see this gets developed a little bit further, but it's the woman and the serpent, or Satan, ultimately. So it's between the woman and Satan there will be enmity. Now this is developed in the second part, between your seed and her seed. What is the seed of Satan? As we follow the argument through Genesis, historical narrative unfolds, I think it becomes clear that mankind can be divided into two groups, two camps. Those who are devoted to and servants of God, and those who are devoted to and servants of Satan. Those are the only two options. Ultimately, those are the only two options. Are we sons of obedience, or are we sons of rebellion? And when it says between your seed and her seed, I think it's talking about those two camps among mankind. So the enmity will be between human beings who are bent on rebellion against God and disobedience, and human beings who are devoted to righteousness and service of God. And there will be enmity between those two camps, between those two elements of mankind. It goes on, he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. The he that will bruise the serpent or Satan on the head is the seed of the woman. So the seed of the woman is going to give a mortal wound to Satan. However, you, the serpent, or Satan, shall bruise him, the seed of the woman, on the heel. So the picture is, although Satan will inflict injury on the seed of the seed of the woman will deal a death blow to Satan. And I think that's talking about the experience that the seed of the woman has throughout this lifetime, that is, those devoted to righteousness. And that is, pain is inflicted by Satan. Satan does draw blood, in a sense. But the mortal wound is done to Satan. In all of the sons of righteousness who conquer over sin, but ultimately by Jesus and his death on the cross, the one who most epitomizes the one who is the seed of the woman. Okay, so that's his description then of what is going to happen to Satan as a result of what has happened here, the deception that has taken place. Then he turns to the woman and he describes how her experience in life is going to be different now as a result of what she has done. And there are two parts to this. And in both instances, it's things that are central in a woman's life. One is, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In other words, one of a woman's main focuses in life, that is the bearing and raising of children, this, as a result of what has happened, is going to be much more painful. It's going to be an agonizing process. And I think this means not just the birth itself, but the whole child-raising process. And as we know, the birth itself is only a prelude to the rest. It's some of the later part that's really more agonizing, ultimately. The other thing that's going to be different is your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, I think what this is talking about, and I should back up just a little bit here. In his comments both to the man and the woman, what he's describing is desires that are built into human beings right from the beginning by God. They had these desires before the fall. There's nothing wrong with these desires. But as a result of the fall, they will now be frustrated in their ability to find fulfillment of those desires. The desire to have children, I am confident, was there before the fall. That was not added as a result of the fall. That was there before the fall. But what is different is that ability to gain satisfaction and fulfillment from having children is going to be frustrated. The desire of the woman to be one with her husband, that was there from before the fall. I think it makes a lot of sense that God built into both man and woman that desire for oneness. So the woman had that desire for oneness with her husband before the fall. What's different is that desire will be frustrated. She will not be able to gain fulfillment or satisfaction of that desire apart from the grace of God. So your desire shall be for your husband, but, I would translate it, but he shall rule over you. That the tendency will be for the husband to abuse his position of authority and lord it over the woman. So that is how things will be different with respect to the woman, to things that are key in the woman's life. How will the man's life be different? If we are going to characterize the key differences. Clearly, some of what says to the woman spills over for the man, and will then vice versa. What will be different for the man is God placed him in the garden to work the soil, to tend and keep the garden. Well, now, as a result of the fall, he will have difficulty gaining satisfaction and fulfillment from that activity. Whereas before the fall, presumably, the ground yielded up its fruit with relative ease, and he gained fulfillment and satisfaction from the work that he did in the garden. Now, the ground is going to be very reluctant in yielding up its produce. It's going to be frustrating. Everything he does is not going to quite work. It's going to be very difficult, and ultimately he's going to feel like it's futile. This work that I'm doing, it's just no good. It's of no value. It doesn't satisfy. It's not fulfilling. The other thing that's going to be different is having worked all of his life by the sweat of his brow, ultimately, nevertheless, he's going to die. That's the ultimate futility in human existence. Because what man did when he ate of the fruit was his first step, his first act of being pretending that he is God. Man wanted to be like God in the sense of being autonomous, making his own decisions of what is right and wrong, striking out on his own, controlling his own life. Well, the most frustrating thing if you're a God is having no control over whether you will be alive an hour from now. It is frustrating being a God and being mortal. They don't go together because you don't have control over the most important thing, your existence. So the ultimate futility then is you're going to die. Now, what man was made in the image of God, there's a sense in which it is good and proper for man to be something special, to be glorious. But it's a certain kind of gloriousness that is good and proper. It is not the gloriousness of being an autonomous God. That is not our destiny. That's not what we were made for. And if man tries to add to the extent that man thinks that he is that, he will be frustrated in his fulfillment of that desire. So in every case here, it's a God-given desire that God is saying, now, as a result of the fall, I am going to guarantee that you will not get satisfaction of that desire. So you can be an autonomous God all you want, but I'm going to guarantee your failure in the most rudimentary, fundamental things that you want to do in order to gain happiness. So that's his snapshot description of how life will be different now. That's not exhaustive, but it's just a snapshot of two different things in the life of the woman that will be different, and two different things in the life of man that will be different now that they are dead, now that God has withdrawn his grace and they are experiencing a life apart from God. It's very curious, verse 20, that at this point in the narrative it would say, "Now the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all the living." I mean, what a strange place to put this in. The only thing that makes sense of why this verse would be where it is because in what God had said, Adam drew some hope. There's a ray of hope there. Adam must have taken consolation from what God had said when he said that he, that is the seed of the woman, shall bruise you, Satan, on the head. That Adam understood that ultimately Satan and evil would be destroyed. And the destruction of Satan would come through the seed of the woman. So Eve is, he calls her the mother of all the living, or the mother of the living. So he sees in this the hope that God had intended in his remarks, and that there is hope for mankind. Then God made clothing for Adam and Eve. He made them out of skin, so apparently he took an animal, he put that animal to death, skinned it, and he made clothes for the man and the woman. Now, he could have made more durable clothes than fig leaves without killing an animal. He could have taken the wool from a sheep, for instance. It would have been a little scratchy, but it would have worked. We know it would have worked. We've done it. But he didn't. What he did was to take an animal and put it to death. So he's creating a very interesting picture here. An animal had to die to make permanent covering for their nakedness. In order to deal with their feelings of guilt and nakedness, an animal had to die. So this becomes a picture then that's drawn upon later. This is, in a sense, foreshadowing the fact that Jesus Christ is going to have to die to make a permanent resolution for our guilt. Then God, in order to, he says that man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever, he puts up a guard to make sure that does not happen. In other words, man has set out and has begun a course of life in which he is autonomous from God. Man wants to be his own God. He wants to be his own boss. He wants to be his own master of the universe. And God says the very worst thing that could happen would be for him to be autonomous from me, living life in a way that he was not intended to live whatsoever, and be in that state forever. As a result, he needs to be banished from the Garden of Eden and cut off from the Tree of Life. So it's an act of mercy on God's part that we have death staring us in the face. So Adam and Eve are chased out of the garden. A cherubim is placed there to make sure that they do not return, do not gain access then to the tree of life. So this then describes the beginning of redemptive history. God decided that he would not allow, he took the initiative and said, I will not allow man to continue to live in this state forever. I am going to set up a situation in which he is faced in to the wickedness of his rebelliousness. He thinks that he is a God. He thinks that he is an autonomous being who can control, or at least pretend to control, his surroundings and decide for himself what is right and what is wrong. That's a horrible situation. That's a disastrous situation. So my strategy is going to be, let him live as a God, and I will demonstrate to him what a bad God he is. What an incompetent God he is. Run your own life. See how you do. That's essentially the dare that God is giving us. And at the same time, mercifully guaranteeing our failure. We will not succeed. We will not gain satisfaction. The thing that's interesting about this is it shows God being very merciful yet firm. Please note how merciful God is here, the provision that God is making. There are severe consequences for man's sinfulness. That's true. And we all experience those every day. But God has made provision. God's the one who reached out his hand initially. God's the one who made permanent clothes for man and woman. And even the consequences of our sin are ultimately redemptive. They are to face us into the reality of our situation and our need for God. They are to demonstrate to us that we make really bad gods. That was not what we were made to be. And as we progress through Genesis, I think we'll see that God is indeed very patient and very merciful in the midst of this life in which we do indeed feel the consequences of our sin. Not the full consequences of our sin, fortunately, but some of the consequences of our sin. Okay. Now, I have a lot of questions here that were given. Several of them were given to me by my father, and then I have some others that were given by various people. Many of them, my answer to the question is I don't know, but that I will elaborate on it anyway. Let me just read through these and respond to each one. We would all like to know more details about what things were like for Adam and Eve and in those times. And we just don't have a lot of information to go on. But having said that, how old was Adam when God made Eve? Don't know. But Adam was given the assignment before Eve was created of naming the animals. Now, if Adam did that in less than a perfunctory fashion, I mean, I'm assuming he didn't just go out and say tiger, lion, elephant, that he actually studied the animals and he came to some kind of assessment as to what is the essence of this creature and give an appropriate name for it. If he did that, it took time, right? So my guess is, if I had been given that task, it would have been at least months, if not years. I mean, there are quite a few animals out there. So presumably, it was a period of time. It wasn't just a day or two. It was a period of time. How old was Adam when their first child was born? We don't know. It doesn't say. We do know that when Seth was born, who was at least their third child, if not further down the line, that Adam was 130 years old. That's what it says in Genesis 5:3. We also know that Cain and Abel had grown to be men, at least old enough to kill each other, before Seth was born. So presumably Adam was 100 or younger when the first child was born. If we look at the times at which the other men in the line of Seth had their first child, I didn't average it out, but just roughing it out, it looks like it's about someplace between 80 and 100, which seems to me kind of late to get started, but I don't know. How old were Adam and Eve when they died? Adam was 930 years old when he died. That's what we see in Genesis 5:5. Eve, we have no indication. Don't know. Where were they living when they died? Were they living in Eden? All we know is that they were not living in Eden. They were banished from Eden, and presumably they were kept out of Eden. Where were they buried? Were they buried in Eden? We don't know where they were buried, but presumably not in Eden, anywhere but Eden. How many children did they have? Well, we know they had three sons. We have those by name. It also says in Genesis 5:4 that they had other sons and daughters, but how many? We have no way of knowing. Were either of them living when Noah was born? With Eve, we can't know. With Adam, if you take the chronology as a closed chronology, and we'll have to talk about what I mean by that later, but if you take it as a closed chronology, and if we accept the dates that are in the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Old Testament, then Adam had only been dead for 86 years when Noah was born. So Adam lived up until, 886 years of the flood, if we take that as a closed chronology and we take the Masoretic text numbers. Did God have conversation with Adam or Eve not recorded in Genesis? If we assume that the wording in Genesis 3:8, where it says that God came in the cool of the day, if that indicates or suggests that God had done that before, I think we can assume that there were other conversations. So I think that's not unlikely, but we have no idea what those conversations would have been. What language did Adam and Eve speak? We don't know. The names Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel, Seth are all meaningful names in Hebrew. But those could be translated names. Those may not have been the actual names that were given. When Adam greeted Eve, he said that she will be called woman because she came from man. In Hebrew, there's a kind of play on words that occurs there. Could there have been a play on words in a different language that Adam spoke? Yes, that could be. We don't know whether Adam spoke Hebrew, a language related to Hebrew, or it's just happenstance that we've got a play on words that works in his language, in Hebrew. So we don't really know. Could Adam and Eve communicate in writing? As far as I know, we have no way of knowing. Did Adam and Eve have an alphabet during their time? As far as I know, we have no way of knowing. I will point out, however, that archaeologically, the earliest writing is not, taking the term, an alphabet, as you probably know, is one sound, one symbol. It's a symbol for every sound. The earliest writing was not in an alphabet. The earliest writing were pictograms, in which a picture stood for a word, and then later, pictures or symbols stood for syllables, so those were called syllabaries. So the evolution of writing progresses from pictograms to syllabaries, and then eventually alphabets. Alphabets came rather late. Did Adam and Eve homeschool? Presumably. And had there been public schools at the time, I would have recommended that they put the commandment on the wall of every schoolroom. Did Adam and Eve know how to start a fire? We don't know that. We do know, however, that a descendant of Cain, Tubal Cain, forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. So presumably he knew how to manage fire. Whether he knew how to start fire, I don't know. Did Adam and Eve eat meat, fish, fowl, or eggs? God gave them permission to eat plants for food. So that's all they've got permission to do. Now the question, are they vegetarian or vegan? Abel, it's curious to note, was a shepherd. It was Cain that was the farmer, and Abel was the shepherd. It seems reasonable to me to assume that he got more than just clothing from his animals, that he probably got food from his animals as well. But there have been cultures that got their clothing and their food from animals without killing them, and that's drinking the milk and making cheese from the milk and yogurt and all kinds of things from the milk. So I think it not entirely out of the question that they drank milk and ate eggs and ate cheese and that sort of thing. The descendants of Cain, however, might very well have become meat eaters before the flood. I don't know. Were Adam and Eve righteous in the sense that Abraham was righteous? What I argued last time and the time before is that right now, currently, my thinking is that Adam and Eve were rebellious deep down in before the fall even occurred, because they had to have been at least susceptible to sin, to temptation, in order for the temptation to have worked. So deep down in, there's a sense in which they were already rebels. But my assumption is that God was gracious towards them in that he, before the fall, spared them the consequences of their rebellious nature. So the way I envision it is that relations between Adam and Eve were harmonious before the fall. Not because they were inherently perfect, but because God was gracious towards them. That after the fall, God withdrew his grace in order for them to feel the effect of their rebelliousness. And relations were no longer harmonious. There was friction that developed, because it's hard for two gods to live in the same house. But I think that Adam and Eve were both truly repentant of their sinfulness. Notice that it says that Seth was in the image and likeness of Adam. And I have argued that that image and likeness is talking about a moral character rather than color of hair. And Seth was the one who was appointed to take the place of Abel, who was the righteous one between Cain and Abel. So Abel was righteous, Seth was his replacement righteous, and Seth is in the image and likeness of Adam. So I think that's an indication that that Adam was indeed repentant of what he had done. And in what God said to the serpent, when he said that, "I will put enmity between you and the serpent, between your seed and between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed," I think that implies that the woman also was repentant. So in that sense, Adam and Eve, I think, were both righteous. They were both repentant of their wickedness, and as a result, were righteous in the same sense that Abraham was righteous. Will we see Adam and Eve in heaven? And I think the answer to that is yes, in the same way that we will see Abraham. How did Moses learn about Adam? Because he tells about creation. So some information had to have originated from God and had to have been revealed to some human being someplace along the line. But it's quite likely that other information was passed down, word of mouth, and some of it in writing, presumably, down to Moses. How did Moses get it? I don't know whether Moses received information from his mother. He was, after all, raised by his mother through God's providence. Or Moses was given the best education that was possible when he was in Egypt. Egypt, at the time that Moses was alive, was preoccupied with the land of Palestine because all of their trouble came from that direction. So they were very interested in monitoring and trying to control what was happening in Palestine. As a result, they had the practice, during the time of Moses, of taking princes of kings that lived in Palestine, taking them as hostages down to Egypt under the pretense of taking them to Egypt to give them a good education. But in fact, they were taking them as hostages. So Moses probably was educated with princes from Palestine, and the inhabitants of the area of Palestine were from a culture that's closely related to the Israelites. So it's possible that there was a lot of written material that Moses could have gleaned from to put together his account in Genesis. Did Abraham know about Adam? I don't know. Abraham did not come from a family of believers. His father, according to Joshua 24:2, worshipped the gods of Sumer. And the names of the relatives of Abraham indicated that they were worshippers of the sun gods and of the moon god in Sumer. So it seems a bit unlikely that Abraham would have received an untainted version of the story of Adam from his family. But he may have received some parts of it accurately transmitted. I just don't know. Where do the dinosaurs fit into the story of Genesis? Don't know. I think it's possible that they were on the earth until the flood, but we can talk about that more later. How does Romans 5, the last half of Romans 5, fit with what I was arguing with respect to Adam and Eve being rebels before they ate of the fruit? Let me read that section of Romans 5. Starting with verse 12 of Romans 5. "Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. who is a type of him who was to come. But the free gift is not like the transgression. For if by the transgression of the one the many died, much more did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abound to the many. And the gift is not like that which came through the one who sinned. For on the one hand, the judgment arose from the one transgression, resulting in condemnation. But on the other hand, the free gift arose from the many transgressions, resulting in justification. For if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one, much more those who receive the abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. I'll stop there. I think the question, the point of the question was, it makes it sound like there was a point in time in which Adam became a sinner. So it makes it sound like there's this one transgression which changed everything. So how can it be that he was a rebel before he ate of the fruit? I guess what I would argue is that he was a rebel before he ate of the fruit, but it had not become manifest. It had not become apparent. So there is a point in time in which his rebelliousness becomes evident. And so it's through Adam's rebelliousness that all of these things are true, and that rebelliousness was manifested in the act of the transgression. So I think that I don't think that there is an incongruity between necessary incongruity between here and in Romans 5 and what I'm arguing. But this doesn't. This Romans 5 doesn't prove it one way or the other. And last question. A couple of people asked me after last week to clarify my comment when I said that there is a sense in which the hunters and gatherers, the primitive man, was better off than we as modern man. What I was arguing is that over time in history, we as human beings have tried corporately to become more and more autonomous from God in a variety of different ways. And there's a sense in which we've made great strides in that, at least apparently to us. It appears like we have become masters of our own destiny. That given enough time, energy, and money, we can accomplish anything. We can send a man to the moon. We can, there's just no end to what we can do. We can manipulate genes. We can do all kinds of things. But I argued last time that there's a sense in which we are worse off as a result of that. And let me see if I can clarify that a little bit. I don't want to romanticize primitive man. Primitive man, they were not angels. And I have no delusions about that. Many were wicked. I mean, it's clear. God sent the flood because at one point in time, Noah was the only righteous man on earth. So just being primitive doesn't make you an angel. That's clear. However, there is something nice about being in a primitive situation. And that is the degree to which you and your life is directly dependent upon God is more apparent. Primitive man, generally speaking, is more religious. Modern man has the luxury of pretending like there is no God. Primitive man can't do that. One disease can wipe out his whole tribe. One bad one bad summer can wipe out his whole tribe. I mean, he is painfully aware of the extent to which there are forces that are more powerful than he or any combination of human beings can be. So they tend to be more religious. What they do with that is another issue. People can be religious and extremely wicked. So that's another issue. But at least they're faced into the fact that they are impotent before the greater forces in the universe. We have created a situation in which we think that we have control of everything. I mean, just think about it. Where do you get food? From Safeway. And the only thing that influences whether you can get food or not is what other people do. If everybody